This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Hello, and welcome to episode 4. Of the People Still Read Books podcast. I am your host, Will Leach. As always, thank you for sticking with us on this podcast. It's getting better. I think it's getting perfect. I am honored, mind you as always, by the way, before I even tell you who's on the show today, to follow us on Twitter, at Still Read Books. Email me, peoplestillreadbooks@gmail.com. It goes through a cadre of assistants and cake tasters before it arrives on my desk, but know that eventually, if it is worthy, it will make its way to me. This week, I am delighted to have an old friend, who I've known for a very, very long time, kind of came up with me in the world of the blogs of sport. His name is Spencer Hall. Spencer Hall, might know him from Every Day Should Be Saturday, his long-running website. These days, He works with the Moon Crew. He has a newsletter called the Moon Crew, which is good. Kind of his old SB Nation guys. Host of the Shutdown Fullcast on Monday nights on the SEC Network, which I get here in Athens, Georgia, but you might not. You can watch him on the show Thinking Out Loud, 7 o'clock Eastern Time. I'm sure he'll talk about the Georgia Bulldogs wipeout of the Auburn Tigers on Saturday evening. But today, he is here to talk about the book that he wrote along with Richard Johnson, Jason Kirk, Alex Kirshner, and illustrator Tyson Wedding. The book is The Sinful Seven, Sci-Fi Western Legends of the NCAA. It is an ebook, and it kind of was a result. SB Nation, or Vox, if you will, laid off or furloughed a large part of their college football staff. SB Nation was very much run as a college football crew, in large part because of Spencer's leadership. And so they put together this ebook, and I remember I sat down to read the ebook, and I thought, okay, well, they put together this ebook. They need something to do in between the time of SB Nation, whatever the next thing is. I'm sure this is kind of some slapped together, 50-page. But I will buy it because I'm supporting them because I love these guys. And it turned out to be like a 325 full, big, huge book. And it's like part novel. The novel part is almost like a Western. Spencer will talk about it, but it's almost like a Larry McMurtry meets a, probably Larry McMurtry, I would say. It's not really the starkness of a Cormac McCarthy. More like a Larry McMurtry kind of matter-of-fact Western. That is also an allegory for the history of college football and is interspersed with essays about college football. It's a terrific book if you like college football. I will tell you, even if you don't know college football very well, you will love Spencer's section because it is fiction and it is written like an old-timey, grab it, the paperback with one hand, buy it at the gas station kiosk, Western. That I know that my family, people in my family have always loved. It's very much an homage to that and a fun one to read itself. Spencer is a fascinating guy. I've known him for a very long time. And you'll love the book. So you can get the book. Just type in The Sinful Seven. You can get in a lot of places. So Gumroad is the best way it's published. But that's The Sinful Seven, Sci-Fi Western Legends of the NCAA. So Spencer and I recorded this conversation before the president of the United States developed a contagious deadly disease that has roiled all of human life on this planet for the past few 7 months. We actually did it before the debate, so not that we were going to be talking the politics anyway, but just know this in a way feels like spoken to you from the before time. But nevertheless, those are all the things that are going on. So anyway, remind you as always, follow the podcast at stillreadbooks. Email me, peoplestillreadbooks@gmail.com, if you'd like to talk about your book on the podcast, or if you represent authors that you would like to have on the podcast. Good shows all around. So now here is Spencer Hall. I am delighted. Can anyone be delighted by anything these days? If I could be delighted by something, I would be delighted to have today's guest on the People Still Read Books podcast. It is the great, the immortal, he cannot die. It is Spencer Hall, author, co-author, and fiction author of The Sinful Seven, Sci-Fi Western Legends of the NCAA. You can tell, by the way, that this was not put through the arms of a major publisher, because the subtitle is not 87 words. It is actually concise and put together like a normal book. Spencer, how are you? Thanks for coming on with me.
I'm about how everyone else is, which is kind of past clarifications between good or bad or various degrees thereof. No, I'm in it. I'm fully in it, and I suspect that, you know, one day we'll all look back on this and we won't laugh, because we'll remember how much it sucked for the rest of our lives.
As someone that is constitutionally, and I would say pathologically, attempting to be chipper about everything all the time, I'm a man with a specific set of skills, and they are being tested. I don't think there's any question about that. But let's talk about happy things, which is the book. And I love the book. I was very excited. I actually, proud to report, I bought your book twice. Because I bought the first time, and then you did like a little promotion on the day of it ran out. And I basically just wanted a shout out from Spencer Hall on Twitter. So I got it. So I bought it twice. I'm fascinated kind of by like the structure of really how it came together, because it's when I first heard about it, I thought, oh, well, this is nice, because I know that we can get into the SB Nation stuff and everything with that. But I thought, wow, this is put together pretty quickly. I bet this will be a little lark. What a fun thing to be able to help support. Oh, no, wow, this is like a real book. This is like a real serious thing on this. And I'm curious how the process came together. You have like this fictional story, this allegorical story that goes along with the kind of the bandits of the NCAA, the all long time idea of the NCAA as the bad guys and the Sinful Seven is the fun Red Dead Redemption-esque bandits of that. And I'm curious, has that a story you'd wanted to write for a while, and you thought, okay, now I can pin to this? Did you guys scramble it together when the furloughs happened at SB Nation? I'm fascinated at how the process even came together so quickly and, frankly, so impressively.
We scrambled to put it together, and it was more an idea to say, okay, well, we're all out. We all have at least 2 to 3 months to do something. What would we want to do? And, you know, for me, it was less a matter of very carefully gauging what the next step in my career is going to be and thinking about, you know, where this puts me brand-wise and what my profile would be. And I don't think it was that for anyone else either. We just wanted to work on something and realize we had the freedom to do it. And if we managed to get a little bit of extra money, you know, in buyout season for the rest of us, then we were going to go ahead and do that. So that's the MO here. Was it's fun to write with these guys, and we've always had fun writing with each other, not just like in group posts, but, you know, in actually doing genuinely collaborative shit. So we just decided to do it. The idea itself just, you know, I think all of us had always wanted to write about the NCAA, and all of us really like Westerns. So it doesn't get much deeper than that. You know, I'm going to give you very disappointing answers in some respects, but I think very pleasing ones in others. And this is probably one of the ones where those overlap, because, you know, like a lot of times people go, well, I chose this genre because of this. Yeah, well, you know, the idea was not to do anything we didn't want to do. And the idea was, I think, for everyone involved, for myself, for Alex Kirshner, for Jason Kirk, and for Richard Johnson, I think the idea was always, if we don't like it, we don't have to mess with it anymore, do we? We can just only do the fun stuff. And it just so happened that the fun stuff for us was a kind of magical allegory about the early days of college athletics and amateurism. That's a very peculiar and kind of deranged idea of fun, but again, not in surprising territory here.
Well, I've been reading your stuff, I mean, forever, as almost as long as I have been an adult, which is to say a couple of weeks. And so I've been reading your stuff forever, and It's funny. I when you read someone as long as I've read you, I feel like I've got an idea for your voice and things that turn out weird. But I have to say, you have an affinity for writing the old for that kind of like paperback Western sort of idea. Is that something you always wanted to do? Have you read a lot of these to kind of capture that voice, or is it really just playing a lot of Red Dead Redemption?
I mean, really, the biggest influence on that voice. There's when you go, okay, well, it's hard, and you've written several books. So you know this. There's a very, for anyone who does it, the first time you attempt to write is always the first time. It doesn't matter. You don't go, oh, hey, I'm slipping into leech mode. No, you go like, well,
never do that.
No, never. It's very chipper. It's a great place to be, man. You know, like you wrote a YA novel. I wouldn't have the first goddamn clue how to even start with a footing of how I was going to talk to young adults, right? Like that's a challenge.
I just turned my chair backwards and said we were going to rap. That was actually how it started.
You know, like maybe. Like, what if you did that and it rocked? You know, like, I don't know. You know, I think if anyone who's ever read anyone who put a book together, when you meet the person or when you read their next thing, you go, oh, they might have just gotten lucky. Like, that's a time. I always think about when Dinosaur Jr., they're one of the few groups of people who've ever met Thomas Pynchon. And, you know,
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah, no, like Thomas Pynchon was a big Dinosaur Jr. fan, so he showed up at one of their shows. And Dinosaur Jr. said, you know, the interviewer asked Dinosaur Jr., hey, you know, guys, like, Thomas Pynchon showed up? And they're like, yeah, he wasn't as articulate as you think he'd be. Oh, which, you know, like that's all to say, it's a production.
Right, and right.
So when I thought, like, well, how's this going to sound? How do you consistently want to sound? My first panic was getting things from point A to B, because I just forget stuff. Like, I'm one of those people who will go, you know, there are four horses. And, you know, 30 pages later, if you ask me how many horses I'm supposed to be writing about, oh, it could be a number anywhere between 2 and 20. Like, who knows? There might just be horses who have randomly wandered into the scene. And I don't feel an innate need to clarify or care that you need clarity on this, right? Are there three horses? I'm like, just go with the story, man. Just let it rock. Does it slap? You know? But in that case, like, the things that I went, well, I think I can consistently, like, I was one worried about making the nouns and verbs line up so that everybody got, you know, because you're writing about multiple characters. So the hardest thing for me was literally like making sure I didn't leave somebody trapped like a sim in a pool, you know, that I wasn't.
It's just left behind, he's gone.
Yeah. Like I will do that. So that was really like any sort of tone may be an accident, because it's really just me trying desperately to not be an idiot and to get everything at the proper time happening at the right rate and with the correct characters in the correct place and names. That's the hardest thing for me. But the second thing that influenced me in that was my favorite big book. Like, if you go, oh man, what's your favorite big book ever? Because I think that's what people, isn't that what people mean when they say,
that's what they're asking. Yeah.
What's your favorite novel? You know, and you're like, oh, that's a book that makes a noise when it hits the ground. Right. Like a big noise.
Right.
You know, they're not asking you like, hey, did you, you know, do you really like, you know, Crying a Lot 49? Because then that's like only 180 pages or something. No, they're asking you like, give me a big pretentious book. And the answer for me is kind of an unpretentious answer. I've always loved Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry. That's an amazing, amazing book. And the voice in that book, like the voice in Sinful Seven that I write in, is somewhere between Larry McMurtry and a really shitty imitation of Charles Portis. That's really like the two, that's kind of where I ended up. And that's not super intentional. That's just if you're writing a Western and you're trying to be real flat and factual and you're trying to occasionally, you know, say things in the way that you would normally say them, which in my case, you know, usually skews a little bit towards, you know, wry. That's where I'm aiming. It's not where I hit, but it's where I try to aim. That's where I try to land. And that's, you know, if you're a little dry and you're writing a Western and you're a little angry, you're going to end up somewhere between Larry McMurtry and Charles Portis.
Well, if it makes you feel better, that's exactly how you write a YA book. It's just exactly like that. So
easy. I'm on it.
There you go. So, it, you know, and I'm starting to keep focusing on the process on this, but like, I'm trying to get the timeline right of when all the SB Nation stuff goes down. April, May?
Let's see. That happens in May.
Okay, so that happens, and this comes out. I mean, like, it's been, I guess it was three months after mm-hmm. that. Did you guys, I'm not a Slack person. I don't know if you all Slacked. I've had no coworkers in so long that I just be, I need a Slack for the household now, apparently, that everyone's home all the time.
That would really help, honestly.
Yeah. But did you, once like the shock of it or the surprise of it or the sadness of it kind of wears off, that kind of idea of like, we're going to get this thing and put this out. I know you talk about it, it's not like a branding thing or like trying to make money, but like at a certain level, you know, there is a certain of, we're not done with this yet. Whatever this thing that we have that we've been working on for so long, we're not done with this yet. Did you float the idea to them? Was it just a, we want to do something overarching about the NCAA and I have this Larry McMurtry thing I want to try? Or is it like, because one of the amazing things about the book to me is how well it does flow between your story and stuff that Alex does. And I think that the Richard story about Jack Trice is really great. But it all does seem to flow in a way that, frankly, it makes me think that the people that are being paid to work on to edit my own book are like being overpaid because it makes something that certainly seems from my angle very difficult. It flows pretty well in the book. Is that just working together for years and years? How did you structure how it was all going to go kind of from the get-go with the four of you?
Well, that wasn't the initial structure. Yeah. Like, yeah, I think it flowed because we thought, okay, we can make it work. Like that's job one. If you're working on a multi-person project, if you're working on a group project, is saying we all have to have faith that this is going to get off the ground and that if we have to move the wings mid-flight, it's not a big deal. We're not going to crash. And even if we do crash, that's fine. This is a zero stakes project. They're my favorite kind of projects where you just have no expectations whatsoever and you can really do some like outright dangerous things and nobody's really going to care. That's my favorite thing to do. So the reason I think it moves together really well was originally the structure was all over the place and we thought we would be able to bounce back and forth between the two stories. And then I think it was Jason. Jason was like, yeah, I don't know if structurally this is going to work. To which the rest of us said, oh, you're completely right. This will be absolute. Like, we're already way out on a limb. We can't ask you to take an experimental story structure as well. So as a group, we landed on the solution of what I deemed the grindhouse solution, which was to take... Just to say, or yeah, in my head, but nobody knows this because I'm not only like E90-bit film snobbish, but also older. None of them had seen Chungking Express. So I was like, it's Chungking Express. We'll just do it like that. To which they were like, what? And I was like, okay, it's Grindhouse. And they were like, kinda, maybe. Like, even that was a little old. I had to be like, okay, look, y'all, two stories. We're just doing it like novella. Two stories. We'll do... A, you know, story A, story B, you know, and they're like, oh, okay, yeah. And everyone agreed on that as the group solution. And that's pretty much the way it went down. And all of these decisions were made. Like, the amazing thing with working with this group, and I haven't mentioned Tyson Whiting yet because I'm just being remiss. Tyson was as much of a creative partner as anyone in this project, if not more so, because he's got the thing people actually see, which are the visuals. And we knew we wanted visuals because people like looking at shit. They do. It's just easier. Like, books with pictures are easier. Tolkien had this down, like, long before anyone else, right? That it's cool to have maps and pictures. That was another thing we kept saying through the whole thing was, oh, yeah, maps are cool. well, why? Well, maps are just cool. Don't you want to open up? Like, don't you want a world? Don't you want, you know, don't you want to go ahead and see where these people are? Like that's where I really realized that, you know, we were working with the right people. Was everybody agreed we needed pictures and maps, but Tyson Whiting, who was also, you know, it just an indispensable member of this, like if we needed a solution structurally, visually, he was like, oh, it can just look like this. We'll just make it look like this. I think that's another reason it works, is that all of the breaks and all of the obvious divides in the stories have these big visual accents, and that helps. You know, at every point we were trying to go, you're already way out on this limb with us. Let's make this transition out here as easy as we can make it.
It's funny because I've read you for a long time. I've read, you know, everyone else involved in the project as well for a long time. And so I you already kind of have me. Like, you'd have to go really far off that limb for me to be like, you know what? I don't like these guys anymore. Like, this is too much for me. You'd have to go pretty far. You might actually have to have a chapter in the middle that's like, Leech is a dick. Like, here's why. For no reason, we're just tossing this in the middle of how we personally dislike this guy. And even then, it would be hard, to be honest. But I'm curious, when you do it, like, obviously, there's a build off the built-up fan base that you've put together for a long time. And those are the people who are going to come after you. But I have to say, one of the things I thought was kind of interesting about the book is I feel... Like, they're like, listen, I live in Athens. You know, everybody here talks about college football all the time, across the board, every single place I ever go, all the time. My favorite thing is to tell people that I write about sports, and they're like, oh, so you cover the Dogs. And I'm like, no, I actually write about, I mean, I guess I write like one piece about them. Like, but the idea that I would write about something in sports that wasn't Georgia feels like weird and strange to them, which I suppose is makes a certain amount of sense. But those people also, as much as they may care about Georgia, they, you know, you and I are old blog people. Like, there's a certain kind of sensibility. There's a certain kind of obsessiveness. If you're reading your stuff and reading Richard's stuff and reading Alex's stuff and reading Jason's stuff for a long time, you really do care about this stuff. Like, this is, and so... So there's a built-in kind of fan base there. What I found kind of really fun about this book, and frankly a little surprising, for particularly as quickly put together as it was, it does feel like a book I could give to someone who does not know any of your guys' work. And they probably need to know a little bit, at least a basic amount about college football. But it feels like a book I could give to them and say, I think you will enjoy this, even if you've never heard of any of this stuff at all. That I was surprised by that, because it really felt like it was going to be just how quickly it was. And it's this group, then you guys had all, as I said, the furloughs had happened, and it felt like we're keeping this going, let's go. It felt like it would be more insidery than it is. Do you want this to be was that always part of the idea, that like not so much this is a thing for a shout out to the people that were with us forever, but an idea of a legit like kind of crossover thing to like not only find new people, but even inform people and make them think differently about the NCAA in a way they might not have before?
One of the reasons why Tyson Whiting is so important to the project as the graphic designer is that to have a specific look, you know, there's so many things that you take in when you pick up a book or when you engage with anything that just give you, that puts you in a spot, even if you don't know you're being put in that spot. And picking it up and seeing an Old West font and seeing that it was obviously kind of in a mode, I think was super important, because people get in that mode first and they're not thinking sports book. A sports book puts you in a certain mode. We didn't want people in that mode. I think that whether it was totally intentional or not, you know, I think most of us who've written about college football in particular for a long time have gotten to the same point where you don't see the sport as being separate or not of a piece with the rest of America as a whole. In fact, it seems closer to the core of what we are and what this entire experiment is about, which is unpaid labor and screwing people consistently over and over again in spectacular fashion. So I think that was definitely at the core of how we wanted to relate to people. So it was definitely for the hardcores in terms of concept, but once you get to that concept, everyone had, you know, to a person, had a real dedication to, no, this should read like a story. You should be able to follow it. It shouldn't take up, it should be familiar, and it should take you to places that you might not think you're going, but at the same time, by working in that mode, it should spring a couple of surprises on you along the way about not just the sport, but the characters and the sort of world that they're inhabiting. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. Irritatingly so. Distribution wise, for me, it's been, first off, I always love anything that reminds me of both old internet and early days of music online, where you pay what you want. Just, it always feels, you know, it's, I'm sure there are stories of people that say pay what you want for something and it totally failed. And they're like, why did we give that away? We should have charged $80 for that. But generally speaking, I find it's usually actually, when you trust your audience, it actually makes a big difference. And it seems to have done very well for you all. Does it feel, you know, that said, you're still stuck talking to me a couple of a while back after it's gone out. You're still in like promotion mode, I suppose. Would you want to go through this specific process? Like if a publisher came to you and said, oh, we love The Sinful Seven, please, we'd like for you to do that for us, but here are all the things that we have to do now. Would you want to go through that process, or would you want to do it like this again?
I would do it like this. Okay. I don't see any reason to use a publisher. None. Absolutely none. I don't see the reason to engage in, I don't see the reason to ask for anyone's input at all outside of the group. I really don't. I am not the person who has the A&R room man in the studio while I'm cutting a track. Right. You either like it or you don't. You pick it up. Like, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago that would have been cool. But like, in terms of the only time I've ever enjoyed even thinking about writing a book, much less finished anything close to book length, is this. And it's because I wasn't worrying about whether it was marketable, saleable, or whether anyone would buy it. I really don't give a shit. Like, and that sort of freedom, that's there is no cap to the value on that. So no, I don't think working, and that's not because I've had extraordinarily negative experiences with publishers or agents, but I just don't like being told thing one about an idea not working. Like if somebody has that idea, right, and they really want to do it, and they're going to end up doing it, like that's, let them do it. Don't try to say, well, you know, wouldn't it be better if you did this? No, like the world is full of bad ideas that became great books, like terrible ideas. Like, give me the pitch for any book that you've really enjoyed, and I guarantee you there's parts of it that just sound absolutely awful. You know, just to like, as a callback to an earlier book referenced, Lonesome Dove. Yeah, I'm going to drop a 1,000-page Western in like 1988 or 86, whenever McMurtry published it. That sounds like, you know, that's box office poison to a lot of people. There may be three or four people who go, oh yeah, dope, that'll be great. And those three or four people would have ended up being right. But no one's right or wrong when it starts. None. Like, every idea. I mean, just like, name another book. Okay, The Big Sleep. I love The Big Sleep. You know what The Big Sleep does? Completely forgets who gets killed in like the first 10 pages.
Right.
Is never even answered. There are publishers like pinheads, little bot people who would say, well, I can't publish this. We don't even solve the first murder. Right? People would have said that with a straight face. Just go ahead and do it. I don't want anyone's impact on this. I mean, maybe that's a sign that I still enjoy writing. If that's good, because I'm passionate enough about it to just go, no, I really don't care what you say about this or think about it. You know, I know whose input I want. And if I ask them, they'll give it to me. But someone I don't know, someone who just has a reputation as an editor, or God forbid, someone from the Northeastern Industrial Media Complex. No. They can kiss my whole ass. I don't care. I would only do it this way moving forward.
So do you have the Jones to do another one?
I don't know. I really liked writing a Western. Like, that was really fun. Like, that was, if I could do pulp Westerns all day, absolutely, you know. And it was extraordinarily fun because you get to write about people who have, like, they get to just, like, because I really like writing about death, and it's very, and violence, and it's very, like, you start with that. You don't have to get to it, right? I don't have to do some sort of construct to go, a normal man pushed to the brink. No, I could just start at the brink, right? Like, a genre where somebody starts at the brink is, I mean, that's why I like football. Like, football gets straight to the point. We don't have to do this thing where, well, now we get to the violent part. No, that starts at the snap. You know, we're engaged. My attention span's real short.
I'm curious if your experience with football, college football. Now, there's a great line Alex Kirshner has in this, and I made sure to write it down, that the history is a series of moments, the college football history is a history of moments that where powerful people came close to realizing that their idea of college sports was incompatible with reality, but plowed ahead anyway. Mm-hmm. That feels like a very accurate representation of what we've seen in the last month or so. Are you watching Are you watching? Are you invested? Does it feel different? Because I'm struggling with this myself. I still love it and it's different, but that's okay. But I'm curious, how engaged are you with college football in this particular way it's being played right now in the pandemic?
Well, I got a TV show, so I kind of have to watch it.
I'm not asking you to make a moral choice, you know, not to watch it, but I mean, how do you feel?
You know.
How do you feel? Like, honestly, you've been watching this your entire life. This is different, and particularly the way that it kind of has been pushed into happening. I also get paid to write about sports that I may have moral qualms one way or the other, but it is different. Does it feel different? Does it feel like part of the history? Like, honestly, how do you feel watching it?
I don't know if I feel any more conflicted than I always have, because and I think if you're honest, you're probably that way about, you know, any number of things in your life. There was an old Bloom County where Binkley ultimately decided he was going to do no harm in life, and he ended up tying himself upside down to a tree by his heels so he wouldn't bruise the grass. And that's kind of where I'm at, going, well, if I follow all of my thoughts to their logical end, it goes right there. And that includes football, and that includes watching football in a pandemic, which is, it's profoundly silly. I don't know if it's any more or less profoundly silly than any number of things people are doing. You know, personally, in terms of my own choices, I'm pretty good with how I've handled it, you know, and I think that it's a very grim and very dystopian thing to be playing in front of cardboard standouts and in front of video boards. And it does feel different. You know, I talked to Scott Van Pelt about this the other day, and I was relieved because he beat me to it, saying, you know, hey, this feels different and weird. You know, does it feel different and weird to you? And yeah, it's going to feel different because, you know, the particular reason I love college football is the absurdity and community surrounding that. And that's gone. Game's completely devoid of that right now. It's just empty stadiums. And in a place like the Big Ten or like the SEC, that matters a lot in terms of the environment, in terms of the vibe you're getting off of the sport. It's like watching, I think the best comparison I can make is right now, it's like watching elaborate scrimmages. Really elaborate scrimmages. And I felt that way about the NBA as well. Like, I think that the NBA in the bubble has been awesome, and they've done it better than anyone else has. And it still feels like it's just got a big old asterisk on it, which is fine. That's just where we are.
Yeah, I feel like I have to trick myself. I went to the first weekend of baseball. I went to a game in Cincinnati, and it took me like 2 weeks to forget that experience, because all I remember from the game is just the droning of the air conditioner.
Yeah, you never heard it before, right?
and it really, it's not, and it took me a while, because now I feel like I can watch a game. I find, generally speaking, I don't want to go too much on the rabbit hole because we only have so much time, but I find, generally speaking, even stuff that, like, you know, I'm sure by if Georgia loses one of these games to Auburn, Alabama, everyone is going to freak out. But on the whole, I've generally felt a lot of the Kirby got to go if he don't win a championship this year feels at least temporarily replaced with, you know what, I'm just kind of grateful that this is happening. I just feel like and not to say that, like, with the same kind of idea that, like, this is a larger thing and my pleasure is not the only thing that matters in this situation, but, you know, as hard as this is for everyone, the idea of having a college football game or having a baseball game, I usually have always blanched at that idea when a broadcaster say it's a good distraction from the world and it's a way to escape your problems and woes, and I've always kind of felt it bullshit.
Yeah.
I've understood it more this year than I've ever understood it before.
I mean, I think it is, but it's also right there. it is weird to see something that's been such a fixed pole and a guide star in people's lives get affected as much as the people, if not more so, because there are people whose jobs really haven't changed that much, and yet football players have had to change how they do everything. And, you know, it is so, and it's, even the good things about it have this really weird edge when you talk about anything positive about the situation, even the hidden positives. You go, well, hey, listen, man, players are just going to be like more tightly medically monitored and get better health care than they've ever gotten and get more information about their bodies. And then I thought, is that something we really want football programs to have? Also, it's a very sad statement to go, wow, they're finally going to get the health care they deserve. Right. In the United States, because of football. That's a, yeah, you put yourself in a real bleak spot talking that way. That is, that's the kind of shit that, that, that even, you can't even escape it in the middle of being really happy that your team hung 51 on Ole Miss, which I want to mention my team did hang 51 on Ole Miss the other day.
Yes. Well done. All right. Well, I, for the, as I said, I am excited for, I love the book and I'm excited the fact that you did it. And I think I mentioned this on, I believe on what your last day or one of your last days at SB Nation. I really feel like I've read just about every word you've written for like 15 years. I still am not entirely convinced that Deadspin would have ever gotten big had it not been for Carl Monday on your side initially. I just don't think that would have ever happened, and no one would have ever cared. And just because he was wearing an Ohio, because the poor kid was wearing an Ohio State t-shirt, I really feel like that changed the course of history. So at least my history. So Spencer, I love the book. I'm excited. I really want everyone to read it. And even if you're not into college football, I really think that there's a lot of value in get, not only giving the book a chance, but frankly, I love the idea of three or four dime paperback book, Western books from Spencer Hall every year. Can you make that happen for me?
You know, we could do one would be fine. Well, one a year is pretty ambitious. So let's take, I wrote like half of one this time. So if I can get to three quarters, I'll feel pretty, by the time I'm 50, I'll feel pretty good about that, you know, but like, yeah, I couldn't encourage anybody listening to this, to read it more, than by saying that, we do all the following in the book. Jason Kirk and Richard Johnson and Alex Kirshner and I combined stage a train robbery. There's kind of, there's speaking with the dead. We had to have that. There's an enormous horse. There's explosions. Somebody does get set on fire because I had to have a man get set on fire. Right. There are female protagonists having discussions about each other without referencing a man. Right.
So I checked the Bechdel test. For the minute I sat down to read the book, I made sure.
We did. No, this book 100% passes the Bechdel test, right? You could make many other feminist criticisms of this book, but it does pass the Bechdel test. And also, we kill an infamous racist. So mm-hmm. like an infamous
gloriously.
There's a fantastic murder of a racist, like a really savory, enjoyable mm-hmm. murder of a racist in this. So what would you like? I keep waiting for somebody to read the book and go, hey, I can't, why'd y'all do that to poor, why'd you do that to him? And I'm like, why didn't we? That should have been page one.
Okay, for the record, if you do get one of those, I please let the world
know. we haven't gotten anybody who was on board with the whole agenda so
until
far.
Until then.
Who, like, took a left turn at that. No,
they're like, okay, everybody now you've gone too far.
No, pretty much everybody who's read that part, you know, has been like, yeah, right on, man.
Yeah. I love that idea, though. Someone's just like, yeah, this is just, you know what? I'm willing to give you the experimentation of the form, but now you've crossed the line. Okay, so the book is The Sinful Seven, sci-fi Western legends of the NCAA. And also, yes, you mentioned your show. I wanted to make sure to call out your show. Thinking Out Loud, SEC Network, 7 p.m. Every Monday, 7 p.m. Eastern, every Monday if you're in Alabama at 6 p.m.
Oh,
7
yeah.
p.m. Every Monday on the SEC Network. I'm excited if I can do that. I'm excited pretty much for everything you do, Spencer. So I'm elated to have you on. Thank you for coming on and chatting with me. And good luck getting back to being at home with your family all the time like me is every single minute of every single day.
Ah, yeah, it's right there, man. It's right there past this door, and I'm about to jump back into it.
I know, so am I. All right. Be safe, and thank you very much, and best of luck with the book, and best of luck with everything.
Yeah, same to you, man. Thanks for having me on.